Ed August's World. Here I am in Chandler, Arizona, with miles and miles of blue skies ranging off into the desert in the distance, where it hardly ever rains. When it does, it comes down in buckets, let me tell you. No snow, never has any snow ever fallen on the ground here. It just goes sizzle if it does, you know, because it's, you could fry an egg on the sidewalk. We already had a 107 degree day a couple of, like, 3 weeks ago, 107. Can you beat that? Then it simmered down into the 90s and 80s. We've had a few 70s. So I don't know. Global warming? You believe in global warming? I'm not sure. Hey, I saw a photograph taken on a bluff overlooking San Diego, just north of San Diego. I think it's La Jolla. And that photograph was in 1884 or 1886. And then I saw another photograph taken at exactly the same place in 2013, I think it was, or 2014. And it was taken during low tide both times. And except for a couple of big boulders that had rolled down into the ocean at the end of the little bluff, everything was, like, absolutely the same. I mean, what I'm saying is it's the sea level. The sea level appeared to be exactly the same in 2013 as it was in 1884. So I don't know. You know, when I see something like that, I say, hey, you guys believe in global warming or climate change? See, they can't quite prove global warming. So now they're saying climate change, watch out, the sky is falling. But I am not convinced, and I'm especially not convinced when I hear a guy like Bill Nye, the science guy. I was looking at YouTube a couple weeks ago, and this was a debate that he had with a guy who was promoting climate change, Bill Nye was, because that's the accepted scientific position on it. All, you know, a lot of scientists have signed on to it, and researchers and whatnot. But this guy was one of his critics, and he had they had a real tangle in some kind of nightly show, some commentary, whatever. And the guy was pretty good. So what he did is he debated him, and then he edited the debate to cut out about 90% of everything that his opponent, the climate doubter, had said. And good answers, you know, and so he could just look down with disdain on this stupid guy who had no arguments, really nothing at all to say. But it was a hoax. The thing was fake news because because the climate the doubter didn't get a word in edgewise because he was edited right out. And that's what I hear happens a lot of time when they have some guest that comes on one of these shows. Doesn't matter who it is, they will edit him down to size, just whittle him down to size so that they can win any argument. So how do we get into climate change? Oh yeah, talking about the weather here. Well, I had a nice break over the weekend. I went up with my dear friend to the graduation of her eldest son from NAU, which is also known as Northern Arizona University. And he was graduating with two diplomas, two degrees, mechanical engineering and business management. And he was electrical engineering. Okay. She just came in to say hi, just at the right time. Hi, she's twiddling her fingers at me. But anyway, no, actually, she's the technician here. She actually runs the place. She turns the lights on and off, and, you know, I'm just a stray character who wanders in every once in a while into her life, you know. But anyway, she was gracious enough to have me come up to Flagstaff. Now, in case you don't know, the Metro Phoenix area, which is called the Valley of the Sun. I wonder why they call it the Valley of the Sun. That's at about 1,100 feet elevation, 1,100 or 1,200. Who's knocking? Somebody's knocking at something. Sounds like woodpeckers. Just imagine they're woodpeckers. They're not going to influence us in any way. Just woodpeckers knocking on the wall. Yeah, it is pretty weird, isn't it? We're doing the show and all of a sudden it's the knock, 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 knock. Yeah, that happened when I was a little kid. And my mom was terrified, just terrified, because it seems like it was ghosts. We'd moved into this old house. It was built in 1880, and my dad was away at work all day, so I was still at home. I was maybe 4 years old. I couldn't have been more than 4 years old, but I remember the terror in her eyes at this repeated knocking. So my dad came home from work, and she told him, you know, this terrible noise. I wouldn't even look outside if I were you. And anyway, that's woodpeckers. Can't you tell a woodpecker? A woodpecker. I guess they didn't have woodpeckers in that part of Europe where she came from, you know. It's easy to think that there's ghosts when you're in an old, you know, house where somebody died just before we moved into that house. And out in the middle of an orchard, like a mile away from the nearest, you know, fences that held back civilization, or what was mistaken for civilization in the Santa Clara Valley at that time. I was on my way up to Flagstaff, however. How did I get sidetracked? I mean, oh, it was the knocking. It was the knocking that freaked me out. So anyway, so as I say, the Valley of the Sun, with Phoenix in the middle of it, is about 1,100 feet altitude. So you go north, and you go drive, and you drive, and you drive, and you drive, and you drive about 35 miles on the other side of Phoenix, and then the hills start, you know, and up around 2,000 to 3,000 feet, there's these beautiful cactus. Are they saharos? Is that what those cactus are? The ones, the stovepipes, you know, that stick up, and saguaros, were those saguaros? The big ones. Yeah, it's a state flower. Wow, I've never seen a flower on one, but she says it's the state flower. And by the way, those are big. I think, you know, if you're ever in the desert and, you know, there's all kinds of cacti that can support life. You know, if you just happen to be wandering through the desert, then, you know, it's a good thing to find a cactus, you know. But anyway, that's two or 3,000 feet. Then there's kind of like this rolling land of hills and mountains in the distance and stuff. Then you get up to about 5,000 feet. And at 5,000 feet, you see the first little stubby little pine trees. You know, just that's, I don't know the exact species. All I can say is they're pine trees, deciduous stuff mixed here and there, you know. And I've seen pictures of Sedona, which is at about 5,000 feet. And that has all kinds of nice shade trees and, you know, deciduous trees of various kinds, and it's just a beautiful picture there with the mountains in the background. Of course, that's a big psychic center there. I was thinking of moving up there, but there's like about 39 different psychics and astrologers and card readers ahead of me, so I wouldn't do something that silly, going to an area that's filled with, you know, other people. They would probably torment me and reject me and kick me out. So anyway, by the time that you get to 6,000 feet, the trees are getting bushier and taller. And as you approach 7,000 feet, trees, lofty, beautiful trees. And, you know, when we got out of the car, there was a breeze, just a gentle breeze rolling through those big, tall pine trees. And it had the sound of the ocean, the sound that the ocean makes as it, you know, goes as it comes on the shore, like in a rolling breaker going over gravel or cobbles, you know, at the seashore. And that's the sound of the wind rustling through the pine trees at Flagstaff. She had been there a week or two earlier and had gone up to the Lowell Observatory, which is at about the 7,250-foot line just above the town of Flagstaff. And that's a place dedicated to Percival Lowell, who discovered Pluto. He discovered Pluto, or at least hypothetically posted his idea on where it would be. I know he was dead by then. I'm saying he discovered it 14 or 16 years before he died. And it was sort of, yes, he did, yes. Well, he didn't discover it, but he said, it's got to be up right up in that area. His thing was Mars? Then why did they name Pluto after him? He founded the observatory. I think he had something to do with Pluto. I've been telling people for years that Percival Lowell was the co-discoverer, you know, before his death, of Pluto because of his initials, P-L. And that is the symbol, P with an L, right, sort of under it and against it. That's the symbol that astrologers and some astronomers use for Pluto. So when you look at Pluto, you see P.L., Percival Lowell. Well, but It's a beautiful place, and the mountains there at night, you know, you can see the Milky Way if you get out of town, and that's always beautiful. It's always such a soulful experience, such a fantastic experience to be able to see the Milky Way and the gas clouds that are in front of the disk of the Milky Way, and knowing that we're seeing a small section of it, but that there's something like 200 billion stars in our Milky Way. And we're traveling along in the sun, poking along at, 40 miles a second or something like that. What's the speed the sun is going around the Milky Way? Do you have an idea on the speed of the sun as it goes around the Milky Way? She'd need a reference point. Well, we could probably Google that up in like 2 minutes, but it's not really important. It's just the fact that, you know, you look up in the sky and you realize there's this big Milky Way, which is like a whirlpool, you know, going around the central point, and our sun is going along with the other stars, generally in the same direction, on the same plane, and our the planets in the solar system are rotating, orbiting around the sun and rotating around their own axis. Are there any planets that don't rotate? They all rotate, don't they? So it doesn't really rotate then.
It does, but
not Mercury does not get around that fast. Even though it's the fastest moving planet, because it's the closest to the sun, it is evidently tidal locked, which means one side of it is burning like hell, and the other one is freezing like son of a gun, because the sun doesn't look like it goes up and goes down. There was a collection of planets discovered that was announced by NASA, discovered a month or so ago, called the TRAPPIST system, TRAPPIST. They're about 40 light years, more or less, away from Earth, and there's seven of them, and they all go around this dark, is it a red dwarf or a brown dwarf? It's a red dwarf. If it was a brown dwarf, we couldn't see it at all. So anyway, and they go around it like the innermost planet goes, goes around that star every 15 hours or something. It's just amazing. I don't think anything would want to live on there, or anything could live on there. I don't know if you would feel that effect, you know, of whipping around the star like they must do there. So anyway, I'm kind of doubtful whether there's life there. But anyway, you think of all these things when you gaze up at the heavens of the Milky Way. You see it over the San Francisco peaks. The San Francisco peaks are, I think, about 11,000 feet or something like that. And they're between the town of Flagstaff and basically the Grand Canyon, which is probably 100 miles north of here. So at Flagstaff, you're still in sort of north-central Arizona, and Phoenix would be in central Arizona, and Tucson would be in southern Arizona, and Nogales would be right on the border with Mexico. And it was a nice drive, but the point of my story is, at 7,000 feet, you know, I got out, you know, to go, well, we were walking up the stairs of a very nice house that her son and friends live in Flagstaff. And it's reminded me of a Victorian in San Francisco with stairs and with a very steep driveway. I mean, this was like a 60-degree driveway or something, you know. You wouldn't want to go up that driveway. They say that during the winter when it snows, when there's sleet and ice, everybody stays indoors because they just cannot get out of the house because everything's frozen over. And, you know, it would be certain, you know, injury to try to even leave the house when it's like, I think maybe that was a story. I think that's maybe either he told me that story or that's a story that I'm telling you about that, but very steep. So anyway, so I'm going over like 35 steps, boom, 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 up to the front door. There's another set of steps. By the time I get up to the front door of this place, I am like bushed because I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3" and, you know, somewhere in the low 200s, 210, something like that. I look like I should have been a football player. Instead, I was a poet, a writer, and a, you know, stargazer. So try to go figure how that works. Anyway, every minute or so, I would have to like breathe an extra breath or gasp for air, you know. And that night, slept on a mattress on the floor. And it's like, how can you fall asleep when you can't breathe? You know, how can you fall asleep when you can't breathe? This whole thing brought back the whole question of mortality and man's suffering on planet Earth, which is so beautiful, and yet we are destined and doomed to do a little suffering here. Some suffer early in life, some have a wonderful life, and then suffer late in life. But it's like you can't get out of here without going through one chapter of the book. One chapter of the book is going to have to be called Suffering, and then I suffered. So anyway, I'm not fond of the mountains anymore. I was looking forward to this trip, but I don't think I'll be back to Flagstaff in a year. Maybe never, because I don't know if it's really healthy for me. Oh, thanks. She's got another graduate going up, walking. As you say, walking. Yeah, but walking is when, you graduate, you get up and you walk up to the podium and they give you your... It's really kind of a fake diploma. You think it's a diploma, but it's actually just a piece of advertising that they give you, But a good time was had by all. And the real diploma arrives in the mail. And it's just a ceremony. It's a wonderful ceremony. And by the way, I'm kind of a sentimental guy. I'm a sentimentalist. Some would say I'm a sedimentalist, Sentimental or sentimental. Anyway, as we were in the stands, he walked once on Saturday, then he walked again for his other degree on Sunday. And there's an orchestra in the center of the arena, and this is in the dome arena, big freaking dome that looks like something out of Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind or something. When you see it in the distance, you think it's going to rise up at you and fly away into the space. What? Or an igloo. Well, that would be a big igloo, let me tell you. So anyway, there in the center of the floor were about 2,000 students, and then the orchestra, okay, before they came in, just as they were coming in, the orchestra strikes up Pomp and Circumstance. I've been doing this for a couple of days now. I've been telling people. I even told Suzanne's other son to listen for this. I said, what I really like about this song? It starts and it goes, dum da da dum da da dum da da dum dum da da dum da da dum da da dum 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 dum. And then at a certain point, so this is kind of like a prelude, right? It does that for about 5 minutes. And then at a certain point, it does this Beethoven thing, or maybe Tchaikovsky did exactly the same thing in the 1812 Festival Overture. The song goes something like, ba 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 ba. And then, right then, starts, da 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 da. Da 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 ba da bum 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 ba da da da. And that song, there's something about it, just melts your heart. It just kind of sweeps you off your feet into reverie and appreciation as the students, the graduates, long lines of them on both sides of the arena come in and, wave to their families and stuff and take their seats. It takes like 20 minutes for them to come in and sit down, because there must have been more than 2,000 in this group. And they had three other graduations also the next day and a different time of day and stuff. So that's a lot of kids graduating. And I was just very impressed. It brought back some old memories. It brought back some old memories of California days and stuff like that. But anyway, so that was my weekend. I was never so happy as when we went down that mountain and we got to like 5,000 feet and those pine trees all disappeared into the distance. I was just almost like waving goodbye. I was telling Suzanne, faster, Suzanne, faster, faster, go faster. That's a mountain road, it's like maybe three lanes each way, but it's still a mountain road. And there was some crazy drivers on there. You got slow trucks and fast speedsters all the way back down to Phoenix. Winding mountain roads, yeah, with some very interesting side trips to Sedona, which I've never taken, and I think it's also continues on that same turnoff, continues on to Prescott, Arizona. Must be one of the isolated medium-sized cities in the world, because it's got about 100,000 people, but it's in the middle of freaking nowhere, nowhere, just A lot of nature around there. It might be fun. It might be fun to go there and look around. But probably not live there. So I'm back, but and I can breathe, and my heart isn't skipping a beat every 5 seconds, you know, every 5 minutes or whatever. So it's nice to get out of the mountains. Now I'd like to go down to the seashore, but the thing about the seashore, I once spent a night in Cambria Pines. Cambria Pines is near San Simeon, which is where Hearst's Castle is located. And it, you know where it is? It's halfway, basically halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles on the Big Sur coast. Well, just south of the Big Sur coast, north of San Luis Obispo and Morro Rock, which is a nice outdoor setting. But Cambria Pines, I got a room in a motel one night, sometime in the 90s, I guess. And this motel was just right above the beach, like 10 feet above the beach, which is a sandy beach there with some gravel and stuff. There used to be jade in it. When I was a young boy and my parents stopped there once, they couldn't get me off that beach because I would pick up all these beautiful green rocks, and there actually was some jade in there. And agates and opals and gosh knows what kind of stuff. Well, you know what? There's not nearly as many rocks. There are stones anymore. The crystals, they have been combed through by thousands, tens of thousands of kids and adults that are looking for gemstones. So that whole beach, which is miles long, has been picked through. But I stayed in Cambria Pines for that one night. So there I was in the motel, and trying to get to sleep because I'd been driving all day, and all of a sudden there's sort of crashing noise, and then seconds go, another crashing noise. It was the waves. It was the waves of the Pacific Ocean that were not really consistent, because they'd come in, but there'd be like a smaller wave, and then there'd be a bigger wave, another smaller wave, another big wave. Then there'd be like a monster wave that you think, oh my God, it's going to come up to the motel and sweep the car out to sea. But no, it wasn't like that. But that sound of the ocean, I don't know, to some people it might be music to their ears. It was not lulling or soothing to me. It was filled with the majesty of the ocean, of the deep, deep ocean, and that covers like 70% of our world. And I just, you know, could not fall asleep that night. So now I know that I'm not good to live in the mountains. I certainly can't sleep very well there if they're over 5,000 feet. And I'm not very good to be on the ocean because, you know, I listen to those waves for a while, and I suddenly start thinking back to some videos that I've seen of the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami in the Indian Ocean, or the 2011 Japan Tohoku great tsunami. And, you know, you see some of those videos with the tsunami coming ashore and houses starting to float away. And it's like, oh my gosh, the sea is so powerful. Nature is so powerful. The processes of nature, the elements, the water element, the revenge of the water element is so intense that, wow, it's intense, all right. And, you know, the one in Japan killed about 20,000 people, although there's many more that are missing. For some reason, they don't want to add those to the death total. They're missing, like, they might, you know, wander back in any time. Ride in from the sea like Aphrodite on her clamshell, you know. I mean, you know, after many years, but we can't say that they're deceased, you know, so we just say that they're missing. Everybody feels better with it. But, okay, 20,000 dead for sure. And then in the Indian Ocean, that earthquake was just a little bit larger, and many more people were living very close to the water, the fishermen, the villages, everything. And so you have about 250,000, a quarter of a million that were killed in that one. So that is the danger of the sea and of the amazing structure of faults in our earth. We hear about the faults. If you look at the faults on the globe, it looks like the, you know what it looks like? It almost looks like an egg, and you take the egg and you crack it a few times, And there's like the crack marks will show in a pattern, going this way and going that way. So something happened to the Earth at some point. I think something bumped into it, some big monstrous thing bumped into it, and it caused all these big cracks. That's all you can call them. They're just great big fault lines, and they're called plates, and between them are the plate boundaries. And so you have the Pacific plate rubbing against the North American plate, rubbing into the Eurasian plate. And I guess there's about 20 of them. And they're very, very sneaky and suspicious to me. I was in a group on the internet years ago, 15 years ago, called Psi Geo Earthquakes, and fascinated by earthquakes. And I started detecting a pattern because I went and looked at these quakes again and again. You'd have a big quake down in Samoa or New Zealand, and then the next quake would be, let's say, in Alaska, and then there'd be one in Japan, and then there'd be one in South America. And you can, they're not necessarily always that pattern, but you can see this big quake. Okay, so if one edge has this quake, then the other side of it responds. Now, what's really strange is, except for the 1964 Anchorage, Alaska quake, which I remember was called the Good Friday quake, caused a tsunami that rolled into Crescent City, California. They have a little museum there. Even today, they have a museum there about their about that event. Except for that one, and then let's see, you have to go quite a ways down, maybe to Mexico, to see the next big, you know, like larger than 7.5 or something earthquake. So that means that all along the American West Coast, actually from the Yukon and Vancouver Island, and the whole Pacific coast from Seattle to San Diego, and Baja and the northern part of Mexico, there has not been one catastrophic earthquake, one big, really big earthquake there in 100 years, 150 years. I think the last one that you could really point to was the Fort Tejon earthquake, which was outside of Los Angeles, north of Los Angeles. I think in probably an area that now you'd call like Santa Clarita or somewhere between Santa Clarita, the Grapevine, and that area, if you're familiar with that, if you've ever driven over the Grapevine from Bakersfield into L.A. or San Fernando Valley into the Central Valley. And anyway, that was like an 8.0 huge earthquake felt throughout California. And I think probably like a dozen, no, it wasn't a dozen, maybe five or six of the California missions, which were established, you know, 50 or 60 miles apart, you know, their roofs fell down, their walls crumbled or whatever during that earthquake. And before that, it was 1812, the Año de los Tambores, you know, the year of the earthquakes, as the Spanish called it, Año, year of the Temblores. And yeah, that happened almost coordinated with the New Madrid quake, which people talk about. There were three New Madrid quakes in late 1811, early 1812, and they popped up in a place in the country. Nobody expected to have earthquakes right there, you know, where southern East Missouri touches the Mississippi River, and it was felt all the way to New England. It was so strong. But of course, in 1812, nothing much had been built anywhere along there, and so it did not have much effect. Chicago had not been founded yet. St. Louis, maybe a handful of homes. New Orleans was there. New Orleans probably suffered some damage. So anyway, the California quake in the year of the earthquakes, there was one in the Channel Islands just south of Santa Barbara. If you know the Channel Islands there, not Santa Catalina, but the other ones like San, I can't remember, not San Clemente, that's even farther south, but the Channel Islands are a chain of islands. There used to have an Indian tribe lived on those islands, and when the quake struck, it raised a tsunami that took a whaling ship about a mile up into a little arroyo or canyon just west of Santa Barbara. So there was a tsunami created, It was probably about 8.0 on the Richter scale. And the surviving Indians rowed ashore to the mainland, and they sat down in front of the mission and said, okay, we believe in your God. They wanted to live there because they don't want to go back to the islands anymore. They were so scared from this earthquake and tsunami that they never wanted to go back to the islands. And then months later, maybe 6 months later, I think it was that summer, there was another earthquake, but this one was centered sort of south of somewhere between Los Angeles and San Diego. And this time it hit, the thing that was hit was San Juan Capistrano, which of course is a beautiful, beautiful church, and the grounds are beautiful. And this is where the swallows come back to San Juan Capistrano the same day of every year. Or that's the theme, that's the story. I'm not sure if that's consistent, always consistent, but that's, you know, a romantic tale from the Spanish mission days. So anyway, this earthquake hit when there were people sitting in church during a mass, and I think about 50 people were buried in big adobe blocks and stuff, and the church was a total ruin. So you know that was a big earthquake to do that. So I wrote a story about 10 years ago. It was going to be the start of a novel. And what I did is what it would have been like. This is a dystopian view. What it would have been like if the earthquakes of the 19th century in America had been in the 20th century. In other words, if the 1812 earthquakes in California had happened in 1912, and if the New Madrid quake along the Mississippi there had happened in 1911, 1912 instead of 1812, and you know, you would have had walls falling down in Chicago, you know, hundreds of miles north and south. Church bells were ringing in Boston and South Carolina from that quake in 1811, 1812. That's how they knew something was going on. So one must have due respect and appreciation for nature and for those who are strong and devout believers in God. You can say God. You can say that, you know, if a big earthquake or tsunami is going to happen, that God must know about it. And then comes the phrase, and God works in mysterious ways, right? God works in mysterious ways that are not known to the likes of man. Well, this has been quite a tirade. Now we're going to take our first break. We're going to have a few little incidentals. She's going to set up something here. My tech is going down a lengthy list of the Freedomizer Radio sound bites. There's about 200 of them. While she's doing that, oh, you're finding it. Okay. She's going
to call. Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
You are listening to Freedomizer Radio, where freedomizers freedomize freedom.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer Radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
You're an activist. You have a cause and an idea, but you also have lots of questions. You need help. After all, teams have coaches, corporations have consultants, and even politicians have campaign managers. But who do activists turn to? The Solutions Institute. We are a collection of professionals and activists from across the political spectrum. Our goal is to teach, motivate, and put all the necessary tools for activism in your hands without charge. Learn more or submit your project at solutions-institute.org.
Call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air.
Are you looking for a new place to shop, eat, and save? Are you sick of paying full price? Would you like to save money at the places you enjoy most? Well, here's a popular savings book that is full of coupons catered to your local area. It's called Save Around. This book is full of exclusive discounts to help you save money around your town. Yes, that's Save Around. You will save money at restaurants, department stores, cars, even flowers. When I take my family out, there are 7 of us. The average meal was about $110 to $140. Last time I took them out, and I'm holding a copy of the receipt right here, the check originally was $120. With the Save Around book, our meal cost $82 at a place we go to quite often. Who knew? And there are a few places we found that we are going to check out. View the books in your area before you buy. Go to freedomizerradio.com or barefootislegal.org. Just click on your city, and within a few days, you will be saving money around town with your new Save Around book.
Call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air. And welcome back. And this is ostensibly a little bit about books today. Every day we talk a little about books, talking a few weeks ago about how best to collect and buy books and also how to sell them. And I looked up, one caller had quite a few interesting books, and a dozen anyway. So he gave me a list of them, and then I took a look and see what I could find. And I have boxes and boxes of old books. I'm sharing space, and I can't really put all my stuff out. In the old days, I would have books in bookcases that were wall-to-wall, literally. Sometimes I would have rooms that look like bookshop rooms, you know, because I've been collecting since I was a kid. So looking through a box, which I put away years ago, I'm finding the North Pacific Surveying and Exploring Expedition. This is a book in kind of like green hardcover binding. It's got not engravings exactly, but it's got etchings in here on the cover. The spine is gilt lettering on top of a green background with a couple of little symbols. What the heck is that anyway? It looks like, oh, okay, it's like a mandarin or somebody that's sitting with his head against a giant mushroom or something. I don't know. It looks like something out of Alice in Wonderland. But anyway, it's very, gilt is like gold, right? So it's like a gilded or gilt-looking print. And fascinating book, The North Pacific Surveying and Exploring Expedition, or My Last Cruise. Hey, after he got back from this cruise, 3 years at sea, he never wanted to see the ocean again. It was like me with the mountains. Where we went and what we saw, being an account of visits to the Malay and Luchu Islands, the coasts of China, Formosa, Japan, Kamchatka, Siberia, and the mouth of the Amur River. I have no idea where the Amur River is. And he doesn't say the Philippines. Maybe the Philippines are the Luchu Islands, as they were said in those days, by A.W. Habersham. Let me see, Lieutenant something Navy, and what a tiny little print, and something of the North Pacific Surveying and Exploring Expedition. Philadelphia, J.B. Lippincott and Company, and London, Tribner and Company. So it was published simultaneously in Philadelphia. That would be the first American edition. Maybe you'd have, yeah, actually, you'd probably have to call it the first edition. And then London would be the first English edition, 1857. Now I turn the page and it says in small print, this is called the copyright page, entered according to the Act of Congress in the year 1857 by J.B. Lippincott and Company in the clerk's office, so-and-so. And there's nothing mentioned here. There's no 1858. There's no, you know, nothing about other volumes or other dates. So when there's no other printing information given, then we know that this is the first edition. And let's see, in there's different rules for that in America or in Great Britain. In one of these countries, maybe it's in America, it tells you if it's a second edition or not. And in England, it tells you if it's a first edition or not. Anyway, this is a very interesting edition. And this is the edition, as I recall it, that has some controversial material. You see, what happened is when they were in Japan, the admiral, or I guess whoever, the captain and some of his crew, some of his officers, were traveling around Tokyo or Kyoto, and there was a bath, you know. And so they went in and they saw what is very common there in Japan is where everybody gets to bathe in the same room. So the plate shows, now I can't find it at the moment, but I know it's in here, shows men, women, children all together, you know, pretty much in the buff. And oh my, when that came out, there was like a bit of a scandal because they were showing people bathing together naked, you know, that were not even related. I don't know. And then it has the captain there wearing his captain's outfit, looking very much out of place. So that made that book more valuable. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to a site that I know of on the internet where I can look up some books, Habersham, The North Pacific Surveying. I wonder if it'll give it to me with just The North Pacific Surveying without having to put all that other stuff in there. Is it new or used? I would say, okay, it's 1857. I'd say it's used. Is it the first edition? Yes. Is it signed? No, I didn't see signed. Binding? Soft cover, hardcover, or any? I'll put hardcover. And keyword, that'll nail it, 1857. So it's like they want a range of dates that it was published. So I'll just put 1857, from 1857 to 1857. So there's no question about it. Now, I don't know what they're going to give me. I'm going to push the button here. What I've seen lately, been very disappointed in the search engines, is that they give you the reprints that were made 5 years ago or 10 years ago and by these reprint houses, which are very prolific. They take dozens and dozens, hundreds of old books, and they give you a reprint of it. And it's a real pain to see a book that is valuable reprinted, usually on bad paper. It ends up looking like it was, you know, just photographed. Not typeset, definitely not typeset, but photographed. Let me see if I click find book, if it turns up. Searching 150 million books. Oh, for Pete's sake, come on, come on. I say, sorry, we found no matching results at this time. Well, I wonder what's that all about. Let's see, Habersham is correct. The North Pacific Survey, I'll put in a few more words. Surveying and, I'll have to take another look at it. Surveying and exploring expedition, I think, wasn't that it? So old and frail that I don't really want to try to juggle, you know, my headset, microphone, and keyboard and Android and other things as I'm looking up this book. An exploring expedition. Expedition. So let's see if this turns it up. I would be very disappointed if this doesn't turn it up. Awesome. Very good. Very good. I mean, the North Pacific Survey and Exploring Expedition, or My Last Cruise, Where We Went, What We Saw. Okay, it was exactly the same thing that I read you by Habersham. So we'll see what's up here. Well, that's pretty good. So there are two copies. The two copies are by exactly the same price. And I see why. Both of these copies are for sale by William Rees Company, Americana, via Antiquarian Booksellers Association. Okay, so it's the same book. He has the same book at the same price. What I don't know is why he listed it. Oh, I see why he listed it twice. The first listing is via Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, and the second listing is from Biblio.com. That's a place where I have a few books also, Biblio. So let's see what he says about this. Philadelphia, 1857, 507 pages plus 29 plates and advertisements, modern three-quarter polished calf and boards, gilt-lettered spine, some internal soiling. Overall, very good. Quote, Habersham was an American naval officer who later became a tea and coffee merchant. He was descended from a family of early English settlers in Georgia who became prominent rice plantation owners and merchants. This expedition, under the orders of Commander Cadwallader Ringo, sailed in June of 1853 for the... and that's... so it's cut off. So it was a major expedition. So his price on this book is $758. So that's good. And but he doesn't really describe the binding, the pages. He just says some internal soiling. What the heck does that mean? Internal soiling would suggest, yeah, that somewhere in the interior pages there could be fingerprints, or, you know, somebody was eating a chocolate bar. You know, the five-year-old was eating a chocolate bar looking at this cute book about sailing, and some of his chocolatey fingerprints got on the pages or the plates, you know. Overall, very good. Very, very good condition, you see. So, in those days, I mean, for books of the mid 19th century, very good is can have a few little tatters and speckles and, you know, a few little things, a little pencil marking here or there. But usually, like when I do a book, I always mention whatever the problems are, the points are about a book, because if I was to sell this book and send it then or something, and the person there looked at it and they said, there is a dog-eared page at, you know, 429. In other words, the page has been part of the corner has been folded, you know, diagonally or something. You say, you did not disclose this. I want my money back. You know, I'm going to send you the book back. You know, COD, and I want my money back. Doesn't happen too often, but it could. It could always happen. Here's another little oddment of some kind. What is this? This is a book called The Law of Scientific Hand Reading. Okay, so this is a book about palm reading. It's a big, heavy, thick book, and it's brown binding with gilt lettering again. It's Putnam Sons, New York and London, by the Knickerbocker Press, which, as you know, is in New York. William G. Benham. And Benham was a well-known palmist. It's a practical treatise of the art commonly called palmistry. So I'm going to flip the page here. Copyright 1900. Uh-oh. Dun, 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 dun. Published December 1900. Reprinted July 1903, February 1906, January 1907, July 1908, October 1909, and January 1912. So this is actually the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. This is the eighth printing. This is the eighth printing of this book over a period of 12 years. So that doesn't mean that it's totally worthless. Believe me, it is not a totally worthless book. But, you know, it's a couple hundred dollars, like the second, well, $800, like the second one. So let me see what I can find about it. I think it would be interesting to look it up. Benham. First, I have to get off this page. New search. I'm going to click on new search. Author. Benham. And the title is going to be The Law. The Laws of Scientific. Okay, I got to type that in with one finger. So sorry about that. The laws I think I pushed the wrong button. It's giving me BS here. Venom. I need a keyboard. Thank you, the laws. I can see for future reference that some things I do on here are going to work out better than other things. One of these probably is not going to work out so well is doing this searching on the database. Scientific. Laws of scientific. And reading. Yes, because it's not just the palm, right? It's also the fingers. It's all that. All that. Interesting stuff. Human appendage. I think people could also read feet. You know, somebody said, yes, there are definitely, there are foot readers, there are breast readers, there are all kinds of readers who look at appendages of the body and can tell stuff. And I just kind of, okay, okay, if you say so. Let's see, hardcover, publication year. Well, we have to pick the latest one. We picked 1912. So that'll give us the 8th edition. Since other years are not going to matter. They're just not going to matter in our calculations here. I'm trying to make out the publisher. I think I want to add the publisher to it so it has a chance to find it. Now, after this segment, maybe we'll be able to get something funny going too. Let's see. So that is Putnam's. That's right, Putnam. I usually just put Putnam because that way I don't have to do the apostrophe, because sometimes you put the apostrophe in there and it blows away the search engine. It doesn't know what to do with it. Putnam. Okay. Crossing my fingers and we'll see what pops up. Searching 150 million books for sale. There it is. William G. Benham, The Laws of Scientific Handwriting. So they give me two different things to look up. I could either look up The Laws of Scientific Handwriting, a practical treatise on the art commonly called palmistry, or I could look up The Laws of Scientific Handwriting, a practical treatise on the art commonly called palmistry, with 800 illustrations from the first one. One copy only? There's only one copy out there for sale of this masterful book. The seller is Lenny's Rare Books. And sounds like a New York shop. Lenny's Rare Books. Publisher G.P. Putnam, 1912, used very good. This is a serious look at palmistry from the point of view of a practitioner. There, quote, there has never been conceived or made by man any instrument, machine, or contrivance capable of such a diversity of usefulness as the human hand. Nothing has ever existed with such infinite adaptability to various needs or capable of being trained to such degrees of dexterity and versatility, nor is it likely that as perfect a machine will ever be produced by human skills. Well, they don't know about robots yet, do they? Artificial intelligence and robots. They didn't know about that in 1912. So this annoys the heck out of me because, again, this is used very good. And there's only one book for sale. He wants $19.50 for this book. Holy Toledo. I mean, I think the book is worth about $40 or $50. So, you know, what I might do is I might send him PayPal for $19.50. Yeah, send me the book. Usually it includes shipping. Usually these kind of things include shipping. I'm going to go back and see what that other book was. I don't know about you. If you're into books, this kind of thing is exciting as all get out because, you know, there's no feeling as fantastic as coming home from a Saturday foray at, you know, the estate sales or moving sales or a rummage or whatever, just plain ordinary garage sales, it doesn't matter. And you have, you know, bags or boxes of books, and it just feels fantastic to just sit down and leisurely look them up and see what kind of gems you've got. So this other copy of the book is sold by Tori Hutchison by Abe Books in the United Kingdom. And he wants $30.76. Now let's see what he says about his copy. Used, 633 pages. Used, but still well bound together, with just some slight looseness. Oh no, Oh, no. Have you ever had a book in your hand that had it was starting to have the binding was starting to go? And that's what that looseness is. When he says slight looseness, I bet you by the time it arrives in the mail, when you open up the book, you know, a couple, 5 or 6 pages will come flying out. Interior in nice, clean condition. Owner's name on the front end paper. Notes on the rear blank. Okay, so somebody made notes. Owner's name. A good working example. Heavy. Weighs 1.3 kilograms. Postage will be 50% more than standard. Okay. Picture of the book is available. That's good. If they say the picture book is available, definitely look at it if you're interested in the book, because then you know what you're getting. Otherwise, you know, it might not be exactly what you thought you were getting. Time to look at one other one. Or are we slipping into the 4 o'clock zone? We're almost at the top of the hour here in the Phoenix area. Here's a book called The Increasing Gold Supply. You know, in the United States, had this big thing going on about gold and silver back in the 1890s, mostly, you know, up until the time the Federal Reserve took over. Even after that, even up to the first Roosevelt administration, you know, when he called in the gold, you know that FDR did that shortly after he was inaugurated. He called in the gold supply of the United States, and people had to sell their gold. They got $35 an ounce for it. So let's say, you know, gold double eagle, which was a $20 gold piece, that would have, let's say, 1 ounce of gold in it. So that would be worth, well, that was actually, to those days, maybe that looked like a good deal, because it was $20 was the face value, but you get $35 if you turned it in. Now, of course, the double eagles are worth thousands of dollars. And, you know, if the person was smart, they would have put some between a mattress or somewhere, you know. The increasing gold supply and its effect on security values, interest rates, commodity prices, etc. Compiled from Thomas Gibson's Special Market Letters, 1908, with an appendix. Published by the Gibson Publishing Company, 15 William Street, New York. New York, New York. And this came out in 1908. So, I don't know, are we interested in gold? Contents, gold depreciation and security values. Increasing gold supply and stock prices. Gold supply, not too great. Review of the world's gold supply. Oh, this is articles. All of these articles are by different authors, and there's like about 10 of them. An appendix includes the history of prices, gold production and prices, an answer to the history of prices, and gold depreciation. Well, there's been no depreciation for the Bitcoin. I think last year, about a year or two ago, they thought the Bitcoin was gone forever. But is it over 1,800? Has it been up to 2,000 yet?
No, it's not close.
Well, I know it's at 1,200, and it had 1,500. I think it's somewhere between by now. Wow. So there's a guy who's on the internet who is a kind of, well, he's a conspiracy theorist kind of guy. He's got really strong opinions about all kinds of stuff that's going on out there, or maybe going out there. His interpretations of things in the news. He's not a really big fan of the Democrats. But anyway, he was making a side career of talking about these different replacements for paper money. He says, why do you want to have a rectangle of paper? A rectangle of paper when you can have gold, you know, gold ingots or whatever. So anyway, oh, okay. Let me see. I want to go take a look at that. This is the kind of book that I might like. I don't know that much about gold except, you know, the guy out in California in the gold country? Maybe that's why they call it the gold country. He had a house with a yard, a couple trees in the yard, and one day, walking through the yard, he stubbed his foot on something, and it was a tin can that was partly sticking out from the grass and the dirt. So he dug around, he found 7 tin cans, and each of them was filled with gold coins, as though from a collection, because there are all these rare dates and old dates. And when the smoke had cleared, and he took them to a specialist, you know, found that was $10 million worth. $10 million of gold coins in the front yard that had been there since approximately 1900, and because all the dates were, you know, before that date. And I would love to see an illustration of that. That would be kind of cool. But that goes, oh, the cans, it shows a picture of it or it talks about it?
Yeah.
Oh, well could you, if you want to, I'm going to be looking up, can you, do you want to share? This is my technician, who is also an expert in just about anything. And that's why she has so many followers.
I'm an expert in search engines.
The show that follows mine today is called Mad Scientists Exposed. And there are a lot of mad scientists out there.
But we're not going to get into any politics.
No.
Here she is. Let me see what she found.
You can't have politics on Freedomizer Radio. It's just not the same.
Oh, okay. I believe you.
Well, so DuckDuckGo, tin cans of gold coins, and so there's lovely pictures of them in the, you know, how they were found in the dirt with the gold coins. And so there's pictures of them before and after they've been cleaned up. Yeah, let's see. And there's articles that's on there. Just California couple finds $10 million worth of gold coins in a tin can. And, you know, this is what I just told you already. So if you want to see them, you can just go to your favorite search engine and put in tin cans of gold coins and you'll see them.
Well, I think it's exciting. When I was a little boy, my parents had friends who had lived in Brooklyn, New York, since they arrived in the country. I've been in the 1920s or so, and they came out to California to visit us. They thought maybe they'd like to move to California. They had some bad experiences in Brooklyn. And when the man arrived, he pulled a gold coin out of his pocket, and he gave it to me as a gift. And it was a 5 rubles gold piece from about 1899. It was from, it had the Tsar of Russia on one side, and that two-headed golden, eagle, a heraldic eagle on the side.
It was pretty cool.
And you know, it's good. It made me start thinking about that kind of stuff. Like I wanted to get piles of that kind of stuff. Not quite so lucky. I had a problem in my 20s and 20s that I would go to a coin shop and I would buy, you know, at retail. And then I would tend to sell at wholesale 25 years later. So 25 years later, when I really need some money and I want to sell a coin, I would take it in. And I know that I had paid $20 for it. And now the guy offered me $12 for it or something. And it's not good when you have to deal with middlemen, you know. This is before the day of Craigslist, when people could just, you know, advertise something. Let's see. Classic search results. All I want is to hit the, come on, let me just hit the freaking button here. Let's see. Here it is. Find a book. Let's see if anything comes up for this guy.
No.
They're going to give me a hard time on this. So I'm so sorry. I had the story here. I wasn't able to give you a good answer. I remember looking at this book a long time ago that this is supposed to be worth somewhere between 15 and $100. So there are some good books out there. I would suggest if you need extra money in your household budget, go to some of these sales where people are giving stuff away. Well, almost giving stuff away. I always call it don't-wanters. People that are don't-wanters.
You've got the eye. You got to tell them how to find them. Don't
yeah, it's just as I've got the eye. Well, the best way of doing that probably is a little paperback book that I did called Get Rich Buying at Yard Sales. And it's currently out of print, or if it is in print, I don't know where they can get it.
It's print on demand.
It's a print on demand book. Suzanne, do you have any details on that? Because I just don't know where it is anymore.
Go to edaugustbooks.com. Let me turn myself on. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Oh, I'm still on. Good. Okay, you go to edaugustbooks.com and click on the menu at a book by Ed August.
Wait a minute. It's down, and you go down to the bottom, and it's one of the clickables. Is that right? It's a special little thing you can put on it, and it takes you to the website that describes the book. Am I right?
Let me look. I'm still looking.
She's going to look so that we don't look crazy or stupid.
But it's on the second page of the books by you. So you go to edaugustbooks.com, you click on Books by Ed August, scroll to the bottom of the page and go to page 2, and then it's halfway down.
Cool. Oh, that's great.
We should make the navigation easier. That's what we should do.
How would you do that?
Oh, I can do it off air.
Okay, we're going to take another break, and then when we come back, I'll fill in the last 20 minutes or so. Reading from an unpublished book of mine that I wrote in 1984 called The Gates of the Buddhas. The Gates of the Buddhas. And there's some funny parts, so I hope you enjoy it. See you in a few minutes.
My name is Dr. Eric Norman. I have studied vitamin B12 deficiency for over 35 years. I have developed a urinary MMA test to detect tissue B12 deficiency early, allowing treatment and prevention of permanent disability. B12 deficiency can cause anemia, but also neurologic problems such as spinal cord degeneration, paranoia, and dementia. B12 is found only in animal sources, so vegetarians become deficient. As people age, they may not produce enough stomach acid or intrinsic factor protein for absorption of B12 and become deficient. Up to 10% of seniors may have a normal serum B12 level, but a tissue B12 deficiency causing a 3 times greater risk for heart attack, stroke, or Alzheimer's. For more information, visit B12.com.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
How would you like to make your work more enjoyable, be more creative and relaxed, all while sitting at your desk? That's exactly what my Serenity Rug has done for me. This revolutionary footrest, I can't even call it a footrest, because this thing encourages movement of your feet, which results in more blood flow. While traditional footrests advocate the motionless placement of your feet, I found that I'm unconsciously digging my feet into the long, soft grass strands of the Serenity Rug. It delivers an incredibly relaxing sensation that closely resembles the feeling of an exotic foot massage. If you have ever had a foot massage that made you want to stay there for hours, you know what I'm talking about. If you have not heard about the Serenity Rug, check them out at serenityrug.com and join the exclusive Serenity Rug community and enjoy a feeling of comfort and relaxation that most will never experience. They've sold out before, so I suggest you do your feet a favor and grab one of these. Again, that's serenityrug.com.
Do you want to live a happy and healthy barefoot lifestyle? Join Barefoot is Legal Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time to learn your rights to live a barefoot lifestyle. There are no laws against bare feet in public, and we are here to dispel the myths and empower you to stand up for your rights. Join full-time barefooter and victims legal advocate Nick Pierce on Freedomizer Radio or the Barefoot is Legal radio show Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific. And check out barefootislegal.org.
Hi, guys. It's me, your host, Red Gypsy, reminding you to come journey into freedom with me every Monday night at 10 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. This is going to be a show that's going to cover everything from metaphysics to holistics to herbs to gardening to barefooting to grounding and so much more. Dare to be you and dare to learn to love yourself unconditionally. Namaste.
Tune in to the Mad Scientist Exposed Show every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, where we discuss the science and the news today, take a closer look, and expose where fraud is being committed for various agendas, from money to politics to downright pure evil and malice. Of course we trust science. It's scientists we don't trust. Tune in and join the conversation on Tuesday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, on Freedomizer Radio.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative. Weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together. Right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Hi. Since it's my show, at August World, I decided to change my itinerary here. I'm not going to read from the introduction of a book that I had written. It just does not seem like what I want to do right now. You know, on my write-up for this show, it says poetry also, so I think I really should read some poetry. We're getting a really bad echo. Why would there be an echo? Is there? I can hear everything recurring in my headphones.
That better?
Is it your? Yeah, no. I'm trying to figure it out.
You don't hear it?
I don't know.
Okay, I read from this book last week. 60 years of American poetry. Of course, it was written 40 years ago, so so now it's more like 100 years of poetry. Robert Lowell was a well-known Boston area poet. I'm not sure what else he was doing. I think his family goes back to the Lowells of the 19th century. You know, those Boston Brahmins, you know, are the blood is thicker than water. This is from his, does it go on to second page? Oh, brother, it goes on to three pages. Well, I'm going to read some of it anyway. For the Union dead, reliquintant omnia servare rem publicam. That's in Latin, but I have no idea what it means. The old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now, its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weather-vane cod has lost half its scales. The airy tanks are dry. Once my nose crawled like a snail on the glass, my hand tingled to burst the bubbles drifting from the noses of the cowed, compliant fish. My hand draws back. I often sigh, still for the dark, downward, and vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile. One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence of the Boston Common. Behind their cage, yellow dinosaur steam shovels were grunting as they cropped up tons of mush and grass to gouge their underworld garage. Parking spaces luxuriate like civic sand piles in the heart of Boston. A girdle of orange, Puritan, pumpkin-colored girders braces the tingling statehouse. Well, think of a tingling statehouse. Shaking over the excavations as it faces Colonel Shaw and his bell-cheeked Negro infantry on St. Gaudens, a shaking Civil War relief, propped by a plank splint against the garage's earthquake. 2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze breathe. Their monument stalks. Pardon me. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its kernel is as lean as a compass needle. He has an angry wren-like vigilance, a greyhound's gentle tautness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy. He is out of bounds now. He rejoices in man's lovely, peculiar power to choose life and death. When he leads his black soldiers to death, he cannot bend his back. On 1,000 small-town New England greens, the old white churches hold their air of sparse, sincere rebellion. Frayed flags quilt the graveyards of the Grand Army of the Republic. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. Wasp-waisted, they doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch where his son's body was thrown and lost with his. Pardon me, that word. The ditch is near. That's the word they use in the poem.
Stop reading.
You're serious. The ditch is nearer. There are no statues for the last war here. On Boylston Street, a commercial photograph shows a Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler, saved the Rock of Ages that survived the blast. Space is nearer. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro school children rise like balloons. Colonel Shaw is riding on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break.
Listen,
the aquarium is gone everywhere. Giant, finned cats nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on grease.
So,
that poem did nothing for me. What's the matter?
I want to pause and pay homage to St. Catherine Drexel. Who was actually in my family tree, you know, over 100 years ago. But she is known for founding schools for little black children all over the U.S. And little Native American children, too. And, you know, from the times, I mean, they've been rewriting the book Huckleberry Finn. I don't know if you're aware of that. But we went through that when I was homeschooling and trying to get a copy of Huckleberry Finn that hasn't been sanitized of the language of the times. You know, it was difficult. But let's invoke St. Catherine Drexel's blessings on us this show, because you're not using any words in any derogatory sense. You're reading a book from the times, and I just had to make that clear.
Well, because it goes back to events of the 1860s when...
Yes.
You know, when he led this brigade or this regiment of black soldiers, and, you know, that was the common terms that were in use at the time.
From what you said, they called the Buffalo Soldiers.
Oh, the Buffalo Soldiers. That's kind of nice. That is.
Yeah.
That's real nice. That's real nice.
They don't segregate the army anymore, though.
Yes, yes. So I have a few of my paperback books here that I dug up. I used to have about 20 of these, all different, and I just can find just a few of them right now. And these were all published by Lulu.com. And unfortunately, I don't have any of my poems in print right now. Somewhere in a box, somewhere far away, probably right here somewhere in a box, is about 400 poems that I wrote going back into the 1960s. And for a while, that was my... there was no fame attached, but that was my identity. That was my claim to a certain kind of fame, is being a poet. And my first book was called Deaths of an Orchard, which I published myself in 1965 when I was about 17 years old. And it was about poems about the orchard that my family lived in that was basically torn down around our ears as parts of it were sold off. And then trees, magnificent big trees, walnuts and oaks, were torn down and burnt or hauled away. And very sad, because I spent my whole childhood in that orchard. And that orchard is no more. And it was a lonely childhood, because there were suburban homes, but suburbs were a half mile or more away. I was the kid that would track, you know, like with mud on his shoes in the winter, you know, as I went to school, because it was quite muddy. There was some gravel spots, but most of it was just dirt and mud. It was a magnificent orchard, and twice a year they would plant the mustards, and the mustard crop would come up. And when I was a little boy, the mustards were over my head, and and that was fun to take off to the orchard. And I would have like a stick of some kind, and I would beat back the plants as I would walk through. And I felt like an African explorer. You know, it was a lot of fun. Are lonely childhoods good for kids? You know, sometimes I think that people should try to have big families, large families, if they can stand each other. I mean, if they can stand each other while they're having these kids and watching the kids grow up. And, you know, the dad doesn't start drinking or take off because he just can't put up with the noise and everything. Fortunately, my parents could put up with me, but I wish I had had a few more older brothers or sisters or younger brothers and sisters so that I didn't stick out like a sore thumb so much, you know, is what happens when a person is practically an only child. So I was practically an only child, but I did have one brother, but he is 16 years older than I am. So there was not the possibility of much simpatico, because he really didn't get anything out of playing with me or teaching me or taking me places. You know, I can remember a few good things we did together, but basically he was in his own world and an artist and university student when I was still tying my own shoelaces, you know. So that's in that poem, Deaths of an Orchard. So that's out of print. It was a funny thing. Even 20 years ago, I found that a copy of Deaths in the Orchard was now in the Santa Clara Public Library in their rare book room. Or maybe it's a rare book cabinet. I don't know. But anyway, I found out that it was there, and I think I came in and autographed it for them or something like that. So they looked at it as a seminal book because they're in the middle of Silicon Valley, and all those green orchards that were the wonderful harvests of prunes and apricots and cherries and walnuts came from, pardon me, you know, were changed by about 1970 or so into future Silicon Valley. And it was tough for the people that remember the old days to see that everything was changing and in some ways falling apart, and all kinds of strangers, you know, entering town, and schools getting more and more crowded. So, yeah, it was a funny way to grow up. But, you know, I read a lot, and I started writing quite a bit. And so one of these little books is called The Magic Wand. I'm kind of interested in magic and the occult and the New Age. And I was not aware of a book out there that was specifically about magic wands. And I had had maybe two or three personal experiences with someone who had a magic wand, or me when I picked up something that looked like a wand and used it like a magic wand and found that it worked. So that inspired me. So this book is, boy, the pagination in here is hard to find. But it's divided into sections. There's about 100 sections. And several illustrations. Well, anyway, yeah, I get kind of sentimental when I look at this. Magic wands, tools, and weapons. Dousing the magic of wood. Swords, rods, staffs, staves, and wands. Natural symbols of power and authority. More about the amazing power of wood. Loaded for magic. Personal theories. What makes magic work? Magic wands, use of the divine by humans, is one step beyond communion. I don't know anymore what I meant by that. Magic wands still being used today. Implicit metaphysical concept. Nature spirits living in trees. Cedars of Lebanon fell, but the great oaks stayed. Linking up with the spirits of trees. Living trees versus dead trees. Discovery of the use of magic wands. Israel Regardet on wands. My driftwood wand that brought back the dead. The most ancient usage known. Aaron's rod was a magic wand. Tapping the rock to find the gushing spring. Escaping Pharaoh's army, parting the sea. Biblical references to wands. Evolution from rods and staves into wands. Undeniable sexuality of the wands. Magic wand used by a witch. Circe in the Odyssey, a painting Circe with her magic wand. Magic wands linked with the tarot card symbols. Hey, that's true, you know, because the wands is one of the suits of the tarot deck, the others being the pentacles, the swords, and the cups or chalices. Subtle and secret evolution of magic wands. The death of the ancient religions, notable ancient secret images. Jesus didn't have a magic wand, or did he? Yeah, there's some report or something that Jesus might have used a magic wand at some point. Ancient artists depicted Jesus as a magician with a magic wand. The magic wand of St. Patrick. Well, Mercury's double snake rod of power. Was it snakes or the people of the snake that he drove out? Dowsers use a similar wood energy, but in a far different way. You know about dowsers, how they can find water and minerals and everything under the earth. Well, black and white, good and evil energies in magic wands. Ancient's Book of Magic, a Latvian witch's birch wand. Best colors for wands, types of woods for wands. You get the idea. So it's about you know, 100 and more pages and many, many sections. It's called The Magic Wands Book by Ed August. And if you go to Lulu, LULU.com, maybe you could go www.lulu.com and then /, and my name, Ed August. And that should bring up a stash of my book inventory, of my books that I wrote myself. Another one that I have here is Dreams and Visions, Changes in Human Species, and my August Astrological Archive. But I have many more. I am what's called an unknown author. I'm probably the most prolific author in Southern Arizona. So where are we right now? 426. So I hope that you've enjoyed this little visit. I feel like I should apologize that I don't have a better, format. Not sure what I have to do to get a better format. There should be some better way that I can put the show together than the way that I'm doing. But we're going to continue because it's a lot of fun. And I'm the first act. I'm just the first act. The next one's going to be Suzanne. Why don't we go out with another couple commercials? You think so? That way we'll have a couple commercials every 30 minutes. There's a song of mine in here someplace. I had some exit music, but I'm not sure where it is. I'll look at that. I'll have exit music the next time we're on. Unless you can.
I can find some.
Oh, yeah? Okay. She's just going to find some exit music for me. Love you out there. Thanks a lot. Send me some email. Let me know what you'd like to see on here. What would you like me to talk about? www.edaugusts.com. Or go to my website, www.edaugustsbooks.com. You can even order a book if you want. Thanks. And here we go out with some music, hopefully.